Who you think you are is not your guru. Who you truly are is your guru. And we have to get over thinking we are who we think we are. But that's very hard, because our whole lives are about me. I was in my room in New York City and I was struck by this thunderbolt. Boom. And at that instant I knew, if I don't sing with people, I will never clean out the dark shadows in my own heart.
Remember Who You Are, a podcast to remember who or what you truly are. My name is Wanda, and I'm happy to explore the fascinating world of spirituality, yoga, and personal development with you. To hear and to learn how we can integrate more love, balance, and fulfillment into our daily lives. Thank you for being here. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode. I am very excited to welcome today's guest. He has been called the Chant Master of American Yoga by the New York Times. And I'm sure most of you have listened already hundreds of times to his remarkably soulful voice that touches the deepest chords in our hearts. I'm speaking about the inspiring mantra and kirtan singer Krishna Das. On a personal note, Krishna Das has honestly one of my favorite voices in the entire world. His mantras such as Om Namah Shivaya, the Hanuman Chalisa, Sita's Prayer, Mary Gurudev have accompanied my life as a yogi and seeker since over 10 years. I remember the very first time I came across The Door of Faith, one of his albums, when I lived back in Bali and I used to practice yoga to this album every day. And for the ones who don't know him yet, here comes the official introduction.
I'll close my ears.
Are you okay with that?
I've learned to bear it.
Enjoy it like a shower.
Okay.
Just a few figures in modern spirituality, particularly in the West, have impacted the hearts and minds of contemporary seekers as such as Krishna Das. Krishna Das is worldwide known for his unique way of singing mantras and giving kirtans. His musical style is influenced by Western styles like gospel, blues, country, and rock, while always deepening the essence of the kirtan practice, the profound calling within the repetition of the divine names. In the 1960s, KD was traveling the U.S. with the spiritual teacher and psychologist Ram Das, who was profoundly touched by an Indian saint, Maharaji. In the early 70s, KD went to India himself to meet Neem Karoli Baba and stayed for 2.5 years as a devotee in the ashram. There he was given the name Krishna Das by Maharaji. The death of Maharaji in 1973 was a turning point for KD. He began to chant as part of following the path of Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of devotion, and began to offer kirtan to people around the world. His path became clear. Since 1996, KD has released 16 full-length albums and was nominated for a Grammy in 2013. Since the pandemic, he's offering online satsangs every week. He is touring every year, offering workshops and retreats, as well as kirtans worldwide. Ram Das said about KD, "Krishna Das is an example of someone whose heart songs open the channels of God." I feel very honored to welcome today Krishna Das.
Hi. Good to see you. Good to be here.
First of all, thank you very much for making time and space in your life to talk to me today, to have this conversation, and to inspire and touch many hearts that listen right now. So first of all, where are you right now? For the people who can't see you and just listen, I can see you are sitting like in a kind of ashram-like background.
Well, that's my office. This is my office. This is where I do what I do. Mm.
Love it.
I live in upstate New York, and that's where I am. I'm finally home for about a month.
Mm. Yeah. So you just came back from a tour?
I think so. I can't remember. Yeah, where was I? I was down in the Bahamas, and I was in Costa Rica before that, going out to California in about a couple of weeks, I think.
Mm.
And then I'll be in Europe all winter, all summer, I mean, from June, July, all around Europe.
Mm. Seems to be a very colorful life you're having.
It's good. Keeps me straight.
Mm.
Keeps me in the right place.
An opening question I love to ask, I guess, is what moves you right now?
What moves me?
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest thing in my life is singing with people, chanting with people. It's, you know, in the old days when I was with my guru, I think the thing I liked second most, the first most thing was just staring at him. But the second most thing was watching people come to see him and sit there and just watch them shed all the heaviness and the darkness and all their stuff and just blossom like flowers. So it's the most beautiful thing. And so now when I chant with people, that's what happens. And I get to see that every night. And it's a beautiful thing. Just watching people get out of their minds, get out of their programs, get out of the way they give themselves such a hard time, and just open up, get present in the moment. It's beautiful.
Mm. Can you do that for us right now to like support us and getting out of our heads and into our hearts?
Say that again. Can we what?
Can you support us in doing that right now? Like,
sure.
You said you would be open to sing a little bit?
I will, definitely, if I can drag my harmonium over here. Good, yeah, happy to sing a little bit. I'll do a little invocation. Mm-hmm. It'll just take a couple of hours, no problem, right?
Which one is it? Which invocation?
This is the invocation I do every night before I sing, or as I'm beginning to sing with people. And I introduce it as an invocation to the love that lives within us, right? You know, to that place within us that is love. And actually, what it is a prayer to Hanuman. Mm-hmm. In India, Hanuman is the perfect servant of that love that lives in everyone. And he's the flow of grace that connects us to our deepest heart. And so I'll just sing it, just be a few minutes, not two whole hours. Suhradaga Basiram Salachapata Atulita Baladhama Emmashala Badeha Tanujavana Krishan Gyaninam Graganyam Sakalaguna Nidhanam Vanaranam Adhisham Raghupati Priya Bhaktam Patajatam Namami Koshpadi Kritavarnisham
Mashikikritharakshasam Ramayana Mahamalaratnam Andinalatmajam Anjana Nandaram Viram Janaki Shokanashanam Kutisamakshanta Andilanka Bhankaram Lungasindo Salilam Salilam Yashokavahi Chanakatma Jaya Adayatane Vidalanka Namamitam Paranjali Ranjaneyam Manojavam Marutta Tulya Vegam Jitendriyam Budhimatam Vardishtam Vatatmajam Vanarutamukyam Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapadhe Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapadhe Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapadhe Anjaneya Matipatala Kanchanad Kamani Avigraha Parjata Taramulasam Bhavayami Pavamanandanam Yatra Yatra Raghunatha Kirtanam Tatra Tatra Krita Mastakanjali Vashpavari Paripurna Lochanam Martinamat Rakshasantakam Lobajaranga Bali Hanuman Ki Jai.
There's nothing left to say. That was the podcast. No, but I feel like there's, yeah, it's just to open this beautiful space where you just want to, you know, bath in more longer. But we're also here to, you know, to learn a little bit more about your path and hear more from you. So you went to India to one of the well-known enlightened masters, Maharaji, in the early 17th. Can you take us a little bit onto your journey? What made you leave the US back then? What was like driving you, or what was the search, the seeking inside of you back then?
Well, you know, in 1970, there wasn't a yoga studio on every block. And there wasn't meditation available. There weren't teachers around. There was really very little, very few places one could go to connect to a deeper place inside, to learn how to connect. And so I just had a very powerful pull to go to India. Then I met Ram Dass in the winter of 68, and we became very close, and he would always talk about his guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And I just got totally lit up. You know, all I wanted to do was go see him. And because the first time I met Ram Dass, when I walked into, he was up at his father's place, living in a little room above the garage in this beautiful mountain area. When I walked into the room where he was sitting without any eye contact, he was sitting across the room on the floor, and he had his eyes closed and he was leaning up against the wall. When I walked into that room, my whole life changed, because at that moment, all of a sudden I knew that whatever it was I was looking for was real, and it was in the world, and you could find it. I didn't know what to call it, I didn't know, you know, but all of a sudden I knew what I was looking for was real, and it could be found. That was a really big thing. And over the next year and a half, Ram Dass and I traveled around together. We did some retreats together with other people, and then finally I said to him, well, I'm going to go to India. I want to find Maharaji. Now, when Ram Dass came back from India that the first time, Maharaji said, don't talk about me. Right? But all he did was talk about him, because he couldn't not talk about him. But he never said his name. And he never said where you could find him. So he kind of got around it that way. But still, I was just burning, and I needed to go. So I said, I'm going. And he said, well, I can't tell you where to go. And I said, that's okay, I'll find him. He said, no, wait. I had no idea. I was just going to run to India and look around, you know. So he put me in touch with a friend of his who lived up in the mountains, who had been a lifelong devotee of Maharaji's. And I wrote to him, he wrote back, and I wound up going. And of course, I stayed in India for 2.5 years. He actually kept me there. My visa, for the tourist visa was up, and they were going to send me home. But he sent me somewhere to get my visa extended. Some devotee of his was a chief of police somewhere, and he stamped my passport, you know. So he saved me from coming back to America too soon. As it was very difficult when I did come back. Mm. Very difficult.
I can imagine. What were your first memories when you met Maharaji?
The first thing was confusion. Because I had been feeling him all the time, everywhere, after that first day with Ram Dass. I mean, anytime I looked, he was there. He was huge. He was everywhere, right? And then I walked into the room where he was sitting, wrapped up in this little blanket. There he is. And I went, wait a minute. I don't get it. How does all that fit inside that? You know, it was like a... And then that went away, and I totally, you know, totally fell in love. Mm-hmm. Again, deeply, much further. And then, you know, then it was just, all I wanted to do was be with him, physically. And I forgot, in some ways I forgot how much I was feeling him. I got attached to his body. I got very attached to his body. I didn't want to be anywhere else. I didn't want to do anything else. And as a result, I was overriding a lot of my innate natural desires in order to stay there. Mm. And of course, he knew that. And he let me stay just long enough before I would explode, and then sent me back to America.
How old were you back then?
And I was 23, and when I came home, I was just going to be 27.
Mm-hmm.
27 or 26? 26.
Actually, most of us, might never have the experience of being with such an enlightened master or have the chance. So can you just...
You'd be lucky.
So how would you describe it, like being in his presence, being in his field?
It was extraordinary. I mean, to meet someone like that, is an extraordinary blessing. And it's very rare to meet a real one. But, and people ask me this all the time, so I don't have a guru, where do I find a guru? I said, no, it's not like that. It may look like that to us because we see everything as if we are the center of the universe and the body is real. And that we are who we think we are. It's not that way at all. The guru is always here. The guru is always available. The guru is looking out of your eyes at this very moment, hearing through your ears. But we are trained by this world, by our cultures, by our experiences, to look outside for everything. And so we miss the point all the time. And to think that you have to meet somebody in a physical body to do in order to become free or to progress on the spiritual path, it's just not true. It's just not. I think it was just us people who weren't going to survive. Everybody, we need it, otherwise we were dead meat. The people who don't, the thing is about a real master, a real enlightened being, everything they do is motivated by only one factor, and that's compassion. They can't do anything that is not in your best interest. Mm. They can't do anything that isn't ultimately the best thing for you. And so that also means if they don't do something, that's also doing something. You understand? So for the people who don't meet a physical manifestation of like that, they don't need that at this point in their lives. They can do everything without that because the physical thing is just the physical thing. It's there and then it's gone. So what happened? I got 2.5 years with it. And the rest of my life, what am I going to do, mope around? So, which I do, but... So a physical guru is... not the real guru anyway, because Maharaji never thought of himself as the body. He didn't identify with the body. But we do. So that's why we look for that. We should look at our hearts and into our own hearts, and we'll find everything we need right there. And the chanting that I do, the names, what they call the names of God in India, are the names of that place in you and me, and everyone that is that love. So the practices that we've been given by these great beings that we can do right now.
Thank you. That's a very profound message, that we can be our own gurus and look into our own hearts.
Not exactly. Can I just say something about that?
Please.
Who you think you are is not your guru. Who you truly are is your guru. And we have to get over thinking we are who we think we are. But that's very hard. Because our whole lives are about me. Everything's in relation to me, me, me all the time. And that's the biggest thing to get over. In fact, when I had this nervous breakdown in the temple. Right in front of him, I was going to go kill myself. I really was in bad shape. And he looked at me and he laughed. He said, "Ah, what are you going to do, jump the river? Ah." He looked, "You can't kill, you can't die. Worldly people don't die." And then he said, "Only Jesus died the real death." What? I'm in a Hanuman temple in the Himalayas in India, and he's talking about Jesus, right? He said, "Only Jesus, why did he die the real death? Because he never thought of himself. All we do, all life long, is think about ourselves in one way or another." So that's all we have to do. Get over that, everything will be fine.
Super easy. Yeah. So, but let's maybe stay for a moment on that guru topic. And because, on the physical plane, we live also in that dual world of contrast, and it's easy to get distracted in the external. So when you say, you know, look inside of yourself and you know, find your truth inside of yourself and your heart, what would you tell people to not get distracted and look in the outside world for the truth and the guru?
Well, the practices that we have available to us have been given to us by these great beings to help us. Okay. As far as getting distracted and as far as imagining that you could find something out there that's going to make everything okay in there, good luck. And the only way to learn is to try and get your head messed over and over again and your heart broken until you finally realize that it's not going to work. Now, unfortunately and very sadly, most people never notice that, never get that wake up that it's not going to work, and they keep trying. Most people in the world don't, you know, they don't, they're not getting the message. For those who get the message, and I'm not even sure if I'm one of them, but I'm saying for those who do get the message, we immediately get, there's a sadness that comes when you recognize that nothing out there will be enough, really. And that sadness is actually a beautiful thing, because that forces you to look, find some other way to live. Whether it's to look inside, that it's almost a meaningless phrase because we don't even know what that means. But it forces you to give up at least trying to make yourself happy with stuff. You know, and that's a really big thing. For that to actually happen, for someone to have that glimpse of reality, that nothing out there will ever make you happy, it's a very powerful thing. And it frees you in a way from that all that anxiety and the trying and the pressure and the grabbing and the holding and the manipulating. You just let it go, because you know it doesn't work. It still takes time to get over those habits. So, be distracted, you know? Like my Indian father said, he said, relationships out of business. He said, do your business, enjoy. Right, you know, but how long can you enjoy? You know, I mean, you do your business, it's okay. You'll wake up someday, you know? You have to do your business. You can't ignore your inner desires. You can't ignore that stuff. You can't kill them and crush them. You have to live through a certain amount of stuff in order to learn and ripen. So being distracted is our natural state. It's the state we live in. As we do practice, we're training ourselves to be freed from those distracting habits. But it takes time. It really does. It takes regular practice, unfortunately.
We don't get freedom for free, somebody once said to me. So, yeah.
Freedom, you know, there's this thing about spontaneous enlightenment. You know, spontaneous enlightenment takes billions of births to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the path of Bhakti Yoga. And you have a very unique style of interpretation of ancient texts and the Sanskrit mantras. And how did that develop? Were there first your devotion and then came the mantra singing? Or were you always like a musical person and it just kind of was flowing out of you? Or how can I imagine that happening?
Mm-hmm. Well, I always, music was very important to me. That's how I got through being a teenager, you know, playing guitar and singing the blues. That was really a big thing for me. It saved my life. And then when I went to India, I had sung, Ramdas would chant a little bit. We would chant together, but it didn't really grab me that much. But when I went to India one night, I was up in this town that we were staying in, up in the mountains, and I was walking around this lake, this crater lake in the middle of this town, beautiful. And I passed by a temple at one end of the lake, and I heard this chanting coming from the temple. I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. And I was just like, what is that? I've never heard anything like that. What is that? And it was like, I was so drawn to it. And I was just standing there like this. And some guy, he's on his way into the temple. He took a look at me and he laughed and he grabbed my arm and he dragged me in. And then I'm sitting on the floor with all these guys singing. And it was like, whoa, this is for me. I said, I can do this. This is for me. And from that point on, whenever there was chanting going on, I went there. I just wanted to absorb it and be with it. And at that point, in my mind, I was never coming back to America. Never. I left everything. And so I wasn't collecting, like, for a career, you know. My high school guidance counselor didn't have chant master as a career in the book. So I just drawn to it, just totally drawn to it. And then Maharaji liked to hear us sing. He liked us, he loved chanting. And so we used to sing to him. And so we used to buy time with him because that was our overriding desire, just be with him every moment of every day. And whereas we might get like some days just like 5 minutes with him, some days an hour, sometimes less. But when we sang, he let us stay. And so that was our way in the door. So that's how we kind of started singing, just like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way of connecting with him. It was a way of connecting with the love. And at the time, I didn't think about it as a spiritual practice at all. It never occurred to me. I just was singing because I wanted to be with him. And now, 50 years later, his body is not available. Same thing. I'm singing to be with him. And when I chant to his presence, and it moves me deeper into that love. It's the same thing. And it doesn't depend on a physical body being there of his, because he's everywhere. Whenever you look, whenever we remember to look, he's here. It's our problem that we don't look very often, that's all. Because of our stuff.
So when you started singing for Maharaji, you didn't recognize it as a spiritual practice. And when did that start that you noticed this, you know, this feeling of devotion? And maybe you can say a few words what Bhakti Yoga really means for you in general, also for people who are not that familiar with that kind of practice.
Yeah, you know, in India, they talk about different types of yoga means coming to oneness, becoming one with something, union. And they say that there's different ways to do that. Through devotion, which is bhakti, through wisdom, which is jnana, through service, which is karma. So they call these different yogas. They're really not different. I mean, it's just you and your life trying to get some shit together. That's all we're trying to do. So, but one thing is, what you love, your mind will orbit around that. Your thoughts will orbit around the one you love. And so, cultivating that kind of loving connection with a guru or deity or being, a great being, that deepens your presence, your ability to live in the moment. So bhakti yoga is the emphasis is on the love. You're not trying to understand anything. You're not trying to figure out how the universe works. All you want to do is be in the love. And in fact, Maharaj used to say, it's better to love everyone than to try to figure it out. So we're working on that, you know. But the greatest, you know, there was an incredibly great being, one of the greatest saints that ever lived, Ramana Maharshi, who used to talk a lot about jnana, wisdom, the inquiry into the self. But he also said that devotion and jnana are not different. So it's just our lives and we're trying to figure it out. And we use whatever tools become available for us that we hope and believe will work. But the most important thing is learning to trust oneself. That's what it comes down to, really. One has to truly connect more deeply with how you feel about something. Is this for me? Does this make me feel good? Or is it feeding the wrong places? It's very subtle sometimes, but the whole spiritual path truly is just learning to trust oneself. Because where is it all happening? In here. If we don't trust ourselves, then we don't trust the process either. We won't give ourselves fully to the practices because we can't sit in our own hearts, in our own beings with ease. It's not easy. We haven't been taught that. We haven't been trained that way. So we have a lot to overcome in order to just exist in a good way. Are we bumming everybody out?
So you you give kirtans, concerts around the world. What can you witness? And you shared a little bit in the beginning of the podcast about the power of kirtans. What do you see in people happening? And you started sharing a little bit about that, about the shedding.
Yeah. Well, first of all, everywhere I go, everybody wants the same thing. That's, you know, when I talk with people in Japan, if I talk to people in Europe and America, so everybody wants the same thing. And the chanting practice that I do is very simple. It doesn't involve any visualizations. It's not hard work. It doesn't, you don't have to understand anything. You don't have to study. You sing. And when you notice that you haven't been paying attention, you sing. That's the whole thing. That's the way I do it. That's the way I share it with people. And so, coming back again and again, and recognizing you're gone and coming back, recognizing you're gone and coming back. Every time one comes back, we're actually planting a seed in our hearts. And they've proven, actually, that the neural pathways in the brain deepen. Certain pathways, every time one returns from dreamland or from being thinking about the future or the past and coming back, there's a pathway in brain or you that deepen. And so over time, it gets easier to come back. You don't stay gone as long, and it's easier to come back to yourself again and again. And then that feeling deepens because you're coming home again, again and again. At first, it doesn't feel like much because we can hardly stay here. But when you're in a room with people and everybody's singing together, it generates this kind of the door opens wider for us in a way when we do it as a group. That's one of the reasons that some of these practices are done in a group way. And so everywhere I go, it's the same. It's amazing. It's just a beautiful thing.
Do you have some stories? I guess you have many things that, I don't know, meetings with people or magical occurrences that happen through the practice of kirtan in your life, or connections that the music made, or, I don't know, healing stories, or just to like have an idea, you know, like what these practices can move also in our physical lives.
Stories, things that happened to me or people I've met, or I'm not sure what you mean exactly.
Whatever comes to your mind.
You know, I love to sing to saints, like the yogis, like in India, you know. I love to sing with them, to them, for them, you know, in their presence. They just look at me and laugh. Ha ha ha. Good, good, you know. Ha ha. Good, good. Go. It's like, I've been really blessed to meet a lot of amazing beings. I mean, on the other hand, I probably haven't been able to learn anything from any of them, but I've met them. And that was fun. And the real India is still here, you know. The real India, the old India, is there. It's covered up and it's hard to find. But the juice from where all this came from is still very strong and very present. And all of us, we're not, you know, even though we've been born in the West, once I had this dream, I was being reincarnated. I was coming back to Earth from somewhere in outer space, right? And I'm shooting right down, and I'm heading right to India, and oh, this is great. At the last minute, I made a left turn and wound up in New York. What?
Damn it!
Oh, no. But this transmission of what's real is available. It's real. It's here. It's available. And all we have to do is bow to that longing in us to find that place, and to trust that longing. It's not easy, because everything out there tells us something else, you know. But and of course, if we really believed any of this stuff worked, boom, it would be a different world for us right away. But we don't. We hope it does. So we do a little practice and we feel like we're really hot shit, you know. And then we get lost the rest of the 24 hours of the day, 23 hours and 55 minutes, you know. But, yeah, it's still available for people. We just have to look. And spiritual practice is really important. That's the one thing. I don't do enough to make, you know, in my own mind, I'm always knowing I'm not doing enough.
But I actually wanted to talk about that with you, about spiritual practice. As Kirtan, chanting mantras is a profound spiritual practice. But do you have, next to this, other practices, daily routines you follow regularly, or you, yeah, could you share a little bit about that?
I love, you know, I hate to say this, but during the pandemic, I was happy as a pig and shit. I was so happy at home. I just, it's the first time I've been, I hadn't traveled in 30 years or so. And it was so nice. And I was doing practice every day, and it was, felt really good. And then I started traveling again, and actually that feels great too. But there are times when I think we really need to do some retreat, take some space where we really just, whether it's day or a week or a morning, you know, where we just carve out some time for ourselves, where we don't let ourselves get busy with other stuff, and we deal with ourselves as we are and let ourselves settle. You know, because it's kind of like a leaf falling off a tree. You know, sooner or later it hits the ground. But if the wind is blowing it all around, it isn't going to hit the ground right away. So you just got to let things settle sometimes and not try too hard. Just be, you know, just let it be. And that's not easy for us. So we add a practice, something, some object that we can concentrate on, pay attention to, and allow the mind to come to gather itself, and, you know.
So you do some kind of meditation?
Do I meditate? Yeah, mm-hmm. I do, sure. Yeah.
You also do some physical practice, or?
Yeah, I do asanas, pranayama. I mean, when I was younger, I started doing asanas when I was like 18. I don't know. I learned from this guy, this Indian guy who was living in the Lower East Side. Somehow I heard about him. Maybe I was 19. And we did it on this hardwood floor with roaches and mice crawling over us. You know, it was just, but I learned a few asanas. I've been doing it for a long time. But then there was a huge period in my life where I didn't do anything. I didn't meditate. I didn't sing. I didn't do any kind of practice for a lot of years. You asked before about chanting. I didn't start singing with people this way until 21 years after Maharaji left the body. 21 years it took him to drag my ass back to where it should have been. 21 years, yeah. But when I did start, this all happened. This just started to happen. I had been singing a little bit with people who I'd been with in India, you know, but in those days it was just like rubbing salt in a wound. It would just be very too emotional and very painful that I was just very destroyed that he had left the body and left me here like this, you know. That's the way it looked at the time. And when I sang, it just kind of made it worse. But in 1994, I was in my room in New York City and I was struck by this thunderbolt. Boom. And at that instant, I knew if I don't sing with people, I will never clean out the dark shadows in my own heart. And it was understood that the shadows were where all the suffering was coming from. And the only thing I had, the only way I had to clean that mess up was to chant with people, not alone in my room. Took me a while to get with the program, but finally I started singing with people. And that's my motivation now too. I mean, I'm just trying to do my best for myself and anybody who's there. I'm not trying to, it's not my responsibility to get people off, to get them any kind of experience, to make them happy or anything. That's not my job. My job is to chant, and when I get lost, to come back again and again and again. And that's all I do.
Yeah, thank you for doing what you do and bringing this light and love through your mantras into this world. And yeah, I like to share a little anecdote from my life, what your mantras Please. Have created, actually, because honestly, it had on some greater level connected me and my current partner, because I was chanting Mere Gurudev, which is my favorite mantra of you, because I feel this deep longing in this mantra so deep, and it made me cry so many times. And I was chanting that actually in Bali 8 years ago. And a friend of mine was recording with a mobile phone how I was chanting because she liked it. And then she put it on her Facebook and a friend shared it. And then my current partner, who I didn't know back then, saw the video and he was like, "Who's that? What is that music? Never heard that kind of music." So he felt very drawn. So he fell in love because of your mantra with me. Maybe, but honestly, it made some connection there. And a couple of months later, we met in Germany and fell in love during a kirtan, actually. And so kirtan and mantra music connected us from the very beginning. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, I just wanted to share that with you.
Just remember, I get 10%, okay?
Yeah. I'm really grateful for what you do in the world and your very unique way of chanting and sharing your love and this longing with us, because it's so precious and it's so soul felt. And, yeah, thank you, really.
Thank you.
I think many, many people are drawn to sing and to express. And as you said, like all over the world, you come and people want to sing. But some people don't know how. And maybe some people listening right now also want to start playing the harmonium and they feel hesitant. What would you tell them, like how to start?
Well, don't quit your day job. That's the first thing.
To become a career test singer.
Yeah. You know, it's all good. But remember, chanting is a spiritual practice. It's not self-expression. It's not entertainment. You don't do it for other people. If it's going to work, you have to be doing it for the sake of your own heart. And that's the motivation is the most important thing. It's not about music. It's about finding who you are. And if you think you're doing something for somebody else, you'll never find your own self. And you'll be creating all kinds of karmas that are not useful. So, you know, yeah, you know, if I had a rupee for every harmonium that's been sold because of me, I could retire. Not I would, but I could. I think it's good. The more people sing, the better it's going to be. But because also the practice itself is a purification practice. And you may start in one place, but as time goes on, through the repetition of the name, our own hearts are purified. So it does help, of course, if we're trying at least to do it from the right place and not get too caught in the egoistic part of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, sure. I mean, if the whole world was chanting, we wouldn't have time to be killing each other, so which would be a good thing.
Yes, very well said. But on the practical term, I mean, your mantras for sure sound harmonious. You have some knowledge. I don't know if you played the piano before, but like, would you say it's good to, you know, have some lessons and to get familiar with that instrument to, you know, then have a few chords to start chanting?
Yeah, as far as the harmonium goes, the last thing you want to do is study Indian music.
Mm-hmm.
Because Indian music is a lifetime study, and it's not to be taken lightly. But if you want to learn to play the harmonium, take some piano lessons. But remember, the harmonium you play just with one hand, and you pump with your left hand or right one hand, and you play with the other. So, yeah, you can learn some chords, that kind of thing, and then you just play. Actually, I've made these harmonium tutorials on my website where people can see how I play my chant. Not because they're better than anybody's chants, but they're the only chants that I know. I could never play harmonium in anybody else's band. That much I'll tell you. All I can do is what I do. They're very simple. And so we made those tutorials so people could learn how to play them at home. And they're really pretty simple, I think. Tried to do it very simply. It shows my hand and the keys I'm pressing, etc. But once again, you don't need a harmonium. You don't need anything. You know, maybe you can use it. If you play guitar, play with guitar. If you play with violin, use a violin. I mean, a harmonium is not by itself any better or worse than any other instrument. It's a good accompanist and instrument. So yeah. You open your mouth and you make noise, make sounds. That's it.
Thank you. Yeah, we will add these links in the show notes so people can find the online courses you have on your website. And
yeah. We just did a whole bunch of new ones last week, actually.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah.
That's great. So we're slowly coming to an end. So you have reached an age of wisdom. I hope it's okay to say that. And we're living in definitely challenging times as humanity. What would you say is most relevant to develop as qualities within us and for us younger generations?
Yeah, it's a hard time. It's a very hard time. Younger, older, it's a very hard time to be living in. And the most important thing is that no matter what's going on out there, it doesn't have to destroy our own hearts. It doesn't have to. It's not required that our hearts are destroyed by what's going on in the outside world. Some people would say maybe it's just selfish by not letting yourself feel what's going on, but that's not what I'm saying. Actually, if we are okay in our hearts, then we actually can feel what other people are going through. And then we actually can be more available to help anyone that comes into our vision. And so the best thing we can do for this world is to take care of our own hearts. And that's what the so-called spiritual path is all about. Learning to take care of one's heart so that one can help others do the same. It's not a selfish, it seems on the outside to be a selfish thing, but it's exactly the opposite. We're all connected. And these days with the internet, you know, somebody stubs their toe in China and we hear about it. You know, so everything is connected. We're all interconnected. Until we're all free, there will not be full freedom for anyone. So the more we learn how to take care of ourselves, we're also learning how to take care of others. It can't be. At one point you realize that, and it's a really big, big thing to have that that experience of interconnectedness, of the interdependence of all of us. The clothes you're wearing, you didn't make those clothes. You didn't grow the fiber. You didn't sew it. Neither did I. The food we eat, the computers we're using, everything we have is dependent on everyone else in the world. And our happiness and their happiness are all intimately connected. Intimately connected. You know, these great beings, they know everything. They know what everyone's going through. They know why they're going through it. It doesn't destroy them because their hearts are as wide as the world. And everything is inside of that. And it's an incredible realization that one can have if one pursues this path with sincerity and openness.
Thank you so much. All right. I feel I could listen to you for another hour or so. But for the ones who would love to do that, you also give satsangs, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever I'm home on Thursday nights here, I do like a couple of hours of chanting and talking with people. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been home that often lately. But during the pandemic, it was every night for like 70 weeks. It was amazing. Every Thursday night, it was fantastic. Wow. But when I travel, I also try to do what we call these workshops, which are like just hanging out together for an afternoon.
When is your next Europe tour?
June, July. I'm coming the middle of June. I start down in Greece, in Mani, at the Zen Rocks, which is a beautiful place out in Mani. And then from there, I think we'll go to Switzerland and London and Netherlands and Austria, Vienna, and then all through all around Germany. So it's pretty much about 7 weeks, June and July.
Not Portugal, by the way. No?
What's that?
Portugal?
No, we tried. We tried. The last 2 years we've tried. But whoever was going to bring us at the last minute, it didn't happen. I don't know.
That's a pity.
We go where we're invited, you know, so what can we do?
Okay. Yeah. So maybe I have to invite you one day.
Okay. We'll be on the way.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I just came to my mind, if we could just finish this podcast off with a mantra, how we open it.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much, Krishna Das, for your time and presence today to be here with us. And yeah, thank you everyone also listening today. And if this episode touched something in you, inspired you, motivated you, please share it with your family and friends and anyone you feel who could benefit from that. And we will put all the valuable information about Krishnadas's work, his workshops, his satsang, and also his upcoming Europe tour into the show notes, so you can find everything under this podcast. Yeah. Anything else you want to finish off with, Katie?
All I can say, if a poor fool like me could get it somewhat together, it's possible for anyone and everyone. So don't give up. Just keep looking for it and you'll find it.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in and listening. If you like this episode, I would be super happy if you share this podcast with your friends and leave me a positive review on Apple iTunes. Because only with your support, this podcast can grow and inspire as many people as possible. Thank you for joining, and we hear us next week.